a Studio B production. Sports can be a real joke, and this is the punchline. It's the Jocularity Show, the train wreck where sports meets comedy head on. Now, here are your hosts, Rick, Aaron, and David Wilmer.
And welcome into the Jocularity Show. I'm Rick Aaron alongside David Wilmer. How you doing, Dave?
I am great. How are you, Rick?
I am doing great. Also, producer Alan Martindale. You know him as Dog from the Dog and Do Show. How's it going, Alan?
I'm doing great, man. Friday night.
Fantastic. We are sitting here in Studio B in Sandy, Utah. And, you know, Alan, you live in Sandy. Dave, you live in Sandy as well. I've been here thousands of times over the years. I still haven't found the beach. Why is this place called Sandy?
Keep looking. Keep looking.
Any ideas? I'm perplexed.
The lady named Sandy founded the area? I don't
know. That's actually probably a good guess.
I don't know.
Works for me. Anyway, we have a fantastic show for you today. We're going to be talking about walk-up music at the NFL draft. We'll also be talking about some tweets of the week involving the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell. Had a little episode on Twitter this week. We're going to be talking to ABC4 Utah anchor Kim Fisher, a Texas gal living here in Utah, and she's got an event coming up that we'll be discussing with her. But we start with a very exciting guest. We have got former BYU linebacker Derek Stevenson in here. Derek, welcome to the Jocularity Show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it.
Hey, Derek, you have been making a stir on Twitter recently. You're bringing up a lot of things. I want to go back over your career, kind of start at the beginning. You came out of Diamond Bar High School in California. You were heavily recruited out of high school. You had a chance to go to a lot of different places. Why did you pick BYU?
You know, I fell in love with BYU when I came up on a recruiting trip and met the man, Lavelle Edwards, and it didn't take him long to sell me on coming to BYU. It was funny. I had just taken a recruiting visit and down to the University of Miami the week before, and Dennis Erickson tried to convince me to be a Hurricane, and walked away from that just blown away with what an opportunity that would be to try and have a great college career and then go to the pros. But then coming and sitting down with Lavelle the following weekend, I saw a school that I could come and play some good football at, but was going to probably give me a better shot at having a good life. And, you know, Lavelle, he didn't try and talk bad about the University of Miami. All he did was send me a VHS tape of them beating up Miami pretty good up here at Cougar Stadium from the year before. And that's really all it took to get me convinced that they could play with anybody. And I thought, you know, if I can come up here and prepare for a good life by coming to play for BYU and also compete with some of the biggest teams in the country, then it's going to be a good fit for me.
So you didn't play much at first, and then as you advanced for your freshman year, sophomore year, you got more involved, especially on special teams, am I correct, and worked your way into a starter's role your senior year?
Yeah, played behind some pretty impressive linebackers, you know, Shea Mearbrook, Spencer Reed, Rob Morris, you know, Brad Martin. You know, we were stacked at linebackers, so I really had to cut my teeth and make a name for myself on special teams, which became a passion of mine. You know, I think I even created a bit of a cult following down there at BYU where, you know, I was known as the Kamikaze Cougar, the guy that loved to go down and break wedges, you know, on kickoffs and try and make big hits and make big plays happen and block punts and kicks, and just fell in love with playing special teams. And then just my senior year, got to start for 1 year. So I did some good things for me, having some good experience on special teams, you know, when it came time to play in the NFL, you know, being kind of a special teams maven really helped me a lot. You know, the only negative was only starting at linebacker for 1 year. You know, that really limited me when it came time to try and play with the Miami Dolphins, just not having a real good, you know, linebacker, you know, not being a great backup linebacker in the NFL kind of really worked against me. But
Do you have a favorite moment when you played for BYU? I know you blocked an extra point in the WAC championship in 1998. That's probably going to be up on your list as your number one favorite moment, right?
Yeah, you know, that WAC championship game, you know, my senior year, I think they were double-teaming Rob Morris a lot that game and even double-teaming the weak side linebacker Brad Martin. So they kind of let me roam free that game and kind of had the game of my career and even, I think, set a record at BYU for number of defensive points. You know, I think I had 20 tackles that game and a couple of block kicks and four sacks and things like that. So, you know, when they let me roam free and kind of do my thing while they were focused on our other really good linebackers, kind of had a career game that game. So that was probably a good memory. But I think the best memory that I had at BYU was probably when we got to go down in my senior year play down at Alabama. Just had an amazing experience just to see what football culture in college is all about. Alabama was quite an experience.
Another great game you had was in the Liberty Bowl against Tulane, even though the Cougars lost that game. You had 11 tackles in that one. What was your memory from that one, taking on Sean King and what would eventually be an undefeated Green Wave team?
Yeah, you know, they really put it to us that game. You know, there were a lot of people going into that game that didn't give them a lot of credit, having run the table on their schedule, not playing great opponents, but they were a great team, and Sean King was a great quarterback. I think we really struggled on offense that year, particularly, and we had a real solid defense, but just didn't have enough in the tank offensively to get the job done.
And around here, I guess you're probably best remembered for a victory against Utah up in Salt Lake City, your senior year, dramatic victory when the field goal attempt that would have won the game by Ryan Canashiro bounced off of the right upright. And then what do you remember about that? And then the celebration and the fight that took place afterwards?
Yeah. You know, we were going nuts. You know, that was the last game that I was going to be playing, you know, here in the state of Utah. And my parents and my whole family came up to watch that, and such an emotional victory. You know, I was so excited after the game, celebrating with my teammates. And then my parents, I ran over to celebrate with them and started climbing up into the stands to give my mom and dad a hug. And there were some Utah fans that were pretty upset about the outcome of the game. And we could all smell the alcohol on their breath. And they came down and they actually, the front row there, up at Rice-Eccles Stadium, there's a pretty good drop from that front row down to the field, a good 8-foot drop. And after I gave my parents a hug, I went to jump back down over the rail and jump down. And one of the Utah fans actually shoved me in the back and I fell those 8 feet down onto the grass. And my old man, who, you know, he probably didn't look like much. He's kind of gotten chunky in his old age. You know, he turned to the guy that pushed me and said, "Hey, you know, that's my son." And this guy just turned to my old man and punched him right in the mouth. Wow. And, you know, I'm lying on the turf looking back up and watching that happen. And I still remember like it was yesterday thinking, oh, man, you should not. I mean, I grew up with this man and he's, you know, former Navy SEAL. You know, he's a bishop in the Mormon church, but he's not a man that you want to go and sucker punch in the mouth. So I jumped back up into the stands to save that Ute fan's life is what I did, because my old man, before I climbed back up into the stands, he probably got about 12 shots off on this guy and broke his nose, broke his jaw. By the time the security and the police could come down and cuff that guy and take him down to the police station, my old man had worked him over pretty good. So is quite the memorable story, because, you know, I turned around and all the media was right there getting a bunch of shots frame by frame, you know, of what looked like in all the still photographs, you know, me grabbing this guy by the back of the shirt and my old man just going to town on his face. I mean, it didn't look good, but once the police did their investigation and everything, they obviously took him in and arrested that guy and told us we were fine to go.
Well, now 16 years later, you're kind of smiling as you tell the story, as you look back and laugh type of thing. But it was pretty serious at the time. I mean, you've actually tweeted out pictures from the newspaper accounts of that fight and everything, and you've talked about it extensively on Twitter.
Yeah, you know, I'm passionate about the BYU-Utah rivalry. I always have been. I've always loved playing up there. You know, I don't want it to die. I'd love to keep that rivalry alive. And, you know, I don't I know there's bad behavior on both sides. You know, a lot of times sports can bring out the worst in people. And I'm a big, you know, I'm a passionate guy when it comes to sports. That's what I love about sports, emotion, passion, you know, getting fiery, getting after people. I mean, that's kind of my thing. That's what I love about being involved in sports. So I seriously, I don't have any hard feelings, you know, towards what happened. I look back on it and laugh. My old man looks back on it and laughs. You know, he thinks it's great. You know, him and Lavelle have joked about it for years, ever since it happened. You know, so I think it's great. You know, I don't have any hard feelings towards that guy at all.
Well, we all know how Max Hall feels about the University of Utah for something that happened years and years later. Do you hold a grudge against Utah? Because you take shots at him on your Twitter account, at Derek Stevenson, D-E-R-I-K Stevenson with a V.
Yeah, I take shots, you know, but it's all in good fun. Anybody that gets to know me, I think initially, you know, there were a lot of Ute fans that you know, used to get offended, but once they get to know me, I mean, it's pretty cool now because a lot of them, and I, you know, we've become, you know, pretty good friends, as close as you can get to somebody just through an online relationship. That, you know, I probably have more Ute followers now that get a kick out of some of the stuff that I say as I do BYU followers. So, no, it's all in good fun. I just, you know, one of my best friends from the college football days is the defensive coordinator up there, Kalani Sitake, and I are still really tight, and I got a ton of respect for that guy. And, you know, he and I have talked a lot about the rivalry, what it means to him. And, you know, it's all in good fun. You know, sports at the end of the day are just all in good fun. So,
well, Derek, you wrote a great article on the lawlessrepublic.com talking about your tour at the University of Utah facilities, your relationship with Kalani Sitake. And you begin it with, "I hate the University of Utah." Where did that start at? With the fight in the stands, or did you have hate?
You know that
before
that was only one of the negative experiences I had with the universe. I had some very real. You know, I don't know how. I've never met Max Hall. I know he truly believes that Utes fans and the Utes are classless, and he believes that. I mean, I had a lot of, a handful of experiences that made it be about more than sports. You know, so I think, you know, also growing up in a little bit of a different era where, you know, I guess things were a little tougher, a little harder, where, you know, you would have coaches or teammates and you would truly learn to hate your opponent. And that was part of the motivation. That was part of the emotion. And, you know, I think maybe just never matured out of that to where, you know, it's truly just a game. I mean, when you're trying to educate yourself and get your college degree and then earn a living with sports, you know, when you're really passionate about it, it becomes more than just a game. And I think, you know, being an emotional guy already, I think, you know, maybe when I was playing the game, I was taking things a little too far and stuff, but you know, I'm trying to grow up. You know, I'm 40. You know, maybe by the time I'm 50 or 60, then, you know, I won't say things like I hate the Utes. But I don't know. Right now, I still kind of do. So,
well, like you said, you're grown up now. You're married. You've got children. You're working in the insurance industry. But based on your social media involvement, you're still very passionate about sports and about the BYU program. What are your thoughts about the current state of the BYU program under Bronco Mendenhall?
You know, I think they're moving in the right direction. I've seen some positive things, especially as I've started to become a little more outspoken. You know, I've been fortunate to be able to go on a lot of radio and do some writing. You know, I've got a healthy outlet for my emotion when it comes to sports these days. You know, folks like yourselves, you know, being kind enough to let me come on and talk. I got more of a healthy outlet than I maybe had a few years ago, but you know, I think they're moving in the right direction. I think, you know, for me, it's a cool thing that they're independent, that they kind of have to stand on their own. BYU has always been different anyway. They've always been unique. And I think highlighting that uniqueness and that independence can in a lot of ways be a strength and can have you recruit guys that really like to stand out from the crowd and be different and be well-rounded and be focused on things that are not just football related. And, you know, I think Bronco's got a lot of those things, and he's moving the program in the right direction in a lot of ways. I hope BYU is open-minded enough, though, to, you know, take some constructive criticism from alumni or from within or from a different perspective and take that constructive criticism and make some improvements with the program, because there are definitely some glaring weaknesses that I think can be improved upon, you know, if we can all come together and support each other and work on a solution together. There are some things that I've seen at other schools that BYU can learn from and improve on and make better.
You outlined those very well in your Lawless Republic article, and you've talked about it on the radio here in Salt Lake City. Basically, you toured the Utah new football facilities with Coach Satake. You saw rooms and players' lounges donated by former players now in the NFL. And your point in the article was kind of, why isn't this going on at BYU? Last week, we had Hans Olsen on this show. He said there's been a disconnect between the current program and the former players at BYU, and that bridges have been burned. Those are Hans's words, not mine. What do you think about how BYU and the current staff relates to former Cougar players?
Yeah, I think there is a disconnect. I think it's, it's an infrastructure problem where they don't have a set program in place that can, make it from one generation of coaches to the next. I think when Lavelle left and Croton came on board and then Bronco came on board, you know, between those three administrative changes, the older generations, the older alumni were kind of lost in a lot of ways. The communication broke down. There wasn't a set plan in place to keep, the legacy, keep the alumni actively involved in helping them grow the program. So I think they're doing a lot of things, bringing guys like Chad Lewis back on board. I think my good buddy Lee Johnson just signed on to help them do a lot of fundraising and reach out to former alumni and to the community so they can get some big things going down there at BYU. I think they're moving in the right direction. I hope they keep it going. I hope they do.
How is your relationship with Bronco Mendenhall and Tom Homel?
I've only met Tom and Bronco a couple times over the last few years, and there's not a real relationship there. I some people last week were giving me a hard time about being vocal on social media and on the radio about not reaching out to them directly instead of going to the general public. And my response to those people that are being critical of me was, I wouldn't have a contact number. I wouldn't know who to go and sit down with and talk to, because, that relationship isn't really there. So, there's a bit of a disconnect between, and that's why I think it's an infrastructure thing where there's not a set program down there with the alumni, where we're communicating by email and by text message and through social media. There's not a constant communication where, I saw the Utes doing a lot of stuff really proactively with their recruits and with their alumni and with their network, where they're just on top of it. They're just being a lot more proactive, with using the alumni to grow the program.
Do BYU, former BYU football players as alumni, do they want to be a part of BYU now, or are they just kind of moving on saying that's in the past, I don't want anything to do with it, because there really is no connection there?
Yeah, I think it varies guy to guy. I heard Luke Staley on the radio last week, talking about how, he's kind of moved on, after 22 surgeries, and it seems like a little bit of bitterness with, the program really never reaching out to him and involving him in the program. He's kind of made the decision that he wants to move on. And but I know a lot of guys that would love to give their time and even their resources to help in a school that gave them a lot. I mean, BYU gave me an opportunity at a life that I never could have had without them being involved in it. They did so much for me, and I have so much passion for wanting more people to have the same experience that I have at, that I had at BYU. I mean, it truly, in a lot of ways, saved my life. It's where I met my wife, started my family. You know, they made me focus on my education, and they're the reason that I have the career that I have today. So many of the blessings that I have in my life came from BYU, and I want BYU to be better at providing those opportunities to other student athletes and other people. And, you know, I truly, if you could see into my heart, you would see that I've got no, you know, ill intent towards BYU. I just want them to do a better job, you know, providing those opportunities to other kids.
Yeah, your gratitude as a parent, and you're a Cougar through and through, but at the same time, it wasn't always smooth sailing for you down in Provo. You went through some rocky times while you were in school there, right? I mean, I've read about an apartment eviction, maybe some anger management issues, an arrest or two.
Yeah, I mean, story of my life, though, you know, up and down. And I think I was lucky at 17. I could have went and played at the University of Miami, where I think I was fortunate. Being a 17-year-old, I had a little bit of vision and some pretty good parents, and then doing a lot of talking with Lavelle Edwards, I knew that I needed a place like BYU to help me be better. And it's hard at BYU now because, you know, back in the 90s, I think BYU, they had the flexibility with Lavelle where they could allow him to be the disciplinarian. They could allow him to work with his kids and use the honor code to try and help make those kids better. And it seems like today now, especially with how kids can be scrutinized and everything's public information, and, you know, BYU doesn't have as much of an opportunity to kind of lift kids up and help them be better people and give them an opportunity at a great life. Where, you know, I look back and, you know, I was always kind of a kid with some rough edges and stuff, but BYU, they worked with me and they helped me get through those rough parts in my life and helped me to become a better man, which is why I am so passionate about BYU. They helped me be a better man. They took over where my old man left off, you know, at 18. He kind of sent me out into the world, and Lavelle Edwards and BYU as a school and the football program kind of took over and started teaching me things that my old man never did about how to be a man and how to live life. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about BYU and what BYU has to offer, especially these non-LDS kids, you know, black kids that aren't Mormon, that didn't go on missions. You know, I think BYU is a unique institution, and I really feel passionately about their mission and their objective.
How does 40-year-old Derek Stevenson feel about 17, 18, 19-year-old Derek Stevenson when you look back now? Because I read a lot of stuff online. I don't know if it's true. I mean, people can put anything online. But it sounds like that you were kind of walking around campus back in those days with a chip on your shoulder. And honestly, it makes it sound like you're kind of a tool.
Yeah. I don't like looking at I was looking at some old home videos of myself when I was 17, 18, 19 years old, and I wish I could reach back in time and smack that arrogant, cocky kid. You know, I'll never forget, you know, coming out of Southern California. You know, I grew up in the early 90s. I mean, it was kind of a rough crowd. You know, it was the Rodney King riots were going on, and I was out running the streets with my buddies, and it was kind of the hip hop culture. And you know, I came up here to BYU. You know, half of me was thinking, man, I need to settle down in life. I need to get straight. I need to be a better person. But there was still part of me that, you know, thought I was a tough guy and stuff. And I started walking around BYU campus like, you know, my stuff didn't stink, and I was cocky and arrogant. And I look back and I wish there were some alumni, you know, maybe that had gone through the program, that could pull me aside as a kid and say, look, you know, you got to grow up. You got to do this. You got to do that. And I think that's kind of, you know, what I'm hoping BYU can do you know, reach out to these young kids who are athletes, and they've got a ton of potential, not only in sports, but in life. And, you know, BYU can have a network of alumni that can really reach out to these kids and help them understand that BYU is not just a place where they can come and play some good football and get an education, but you want to set yourself up for the rest of life. I mean, there's no better school to do it at than BYU. And if BYU can start to preach that message, I mean, you could sell that to, you know, young African-American single moms trying to raise a kid down in L.A. I mean, that concept will sell. There's a lot more in common with BYU's message like that with some of these athletes that are growing up in Houston or growing up in Miami or growing up in L.A. I mean, there's a lot that BYU has to offer. And, you know, looking back at myself, you know, I was a bit of a punk. And, you know, I wish somebody would have been there to smack me upside the head and, you know, back looking back on those times.
Hearing this from you now, I just think, how would your life have been differently had you gone to the University of Miami and gotten embroiled in that whole era and culture down there, the Two Live Crew rap music and the celebrating, yeah, you know, after the touchdowns and all that stuff. What do you think would have happened had you gone to Miami?
I wouldn't be here. You know, I don't know, you know, when we went down there, you know, Luke Skywalker, Two Live Crew, he was one of our hosts for that weekend trip. I mean, and we went out to clubs, you know, my fake ID was pre-printed up when I got off the plane. You know, there was a 24 pack of beer on my bed in my hotel room. We had phone numbers for women, that were going to be our hostesses for the evening that we were to reach out and call. And, you know, there was me and 20 other recruits. And I think I was the only guy that was fortunate enough, I think. And I still look back and I'm amazed that I had just a tiny bit of maturity in me and a tiny bit of vision and just say, Derek, if you go here, you're going to be toast, man. You're going to get caught up in a lifestyle that you're never going to get out of. And, you know, making the decision to come to BYU, you know, I was still a tool, you know, but I at least had enough, you know. I had guys like Lavelle. He pulled me into his office a couple times and he just said, son, and he grabbed me by the collar once and he pushed me up against the wall. And he just said, son, you have got to stop this. You've got to knock it off. You've got to grow up. You've got to get to class. You've got to get A's. You've got to get B's. And it was just such a huge blessing to have BYU in my life. If I had gone to the University of Miami, man, it would have been a blast, but it would have been for a couple of years and Derek would have been in jail. Derek never would have met a beautiful young lady. I got four beautiful daughters now. And it's just, BYU has given me an opportunity to have an amazing life. And it's so much bigger than sports for me, but you know, I always look back and I'm so passionate and grateful for football and for sports because, you know, that was kind of the door opener for everything.
We've been talking a lot about changes for the alumni at BYU. What kind of changes do you want to see now for the football program? Maybe a stadium upgrade of some sort or maybe a schedule upgrade of some sort for BYU?
Yeah, you know, I know Tom's doing everything he can from a scheduling perspective. He's out there fighting tooth and nail to try and get the best schedule pulled together that he can. I think, you know, the upgrades have got to happen. Man, I don't know if you guys have seen the website kylefield.com. What Texas A&M is doing with their stadium.
With the SEC money coming in now.
With that SEC money. And I look at what Utah's doing and them breaking ground on their basketball facilities just last week. And I hope BYU is ready to make the financial commitments that they're going to have to make with this changing college landscape in order to be competitive with recruiting and with building up your program, because there are some huge things coming that people, I don't think everybody at BYU understands how big they're going to have to take things in order to be able to compete, especially if we stay independent. You know, we got to get into one of these conferences, unfortunately. It's going to have to happen. And then there's going to have to be a lot of people at higher levels of BYU and the church that are ready to make the financial commitment. I mean, go to kylefield.com and watch that 5-minute video on what they're putting into their facilities and their stadium. It'll absolutely blow your mind, and it'll give you a little taste of where college football's going. It's not about getting an education anymore. It's going to be a professional sports organization. It's going to be the minor leagues for the NFL, and everybody's going to have to pony up some big, big bucks. I just hope to heaven that BYU is ready to get into the professional sports business, because that is where this whole thing's going. So, and if we don't have the alumni at BYU all in, and the boosters and the fans ready to pony, I mean, Mormons are notoriously cheap, but you guys are going to have to, you're going to have to get all in with this. If you want BYU to be a big program, everybody is going to have to chip in and make some good things happen.
Maybe a new field on the tithing slip in church to BYU football stadium fund.
Add another 1% to the 10% already going to the church.
11% if you want a good team, man.
Hey, 11 players on the field, 11%. There you go. It makes sense. Finally, Derek, I'm going to ask you about the schedule. And for the first time in forever, basically, no BYU-Utah game. Now, I joked on Twitter that the only place the BYU-Utah rivalry is going on these days is on your Twitter timeline. What are your thoughts about the series going away for 2 years and maybe being sporadic at best from here on out?
Yeah, you know, with money and TV, you know, that killed the rivalry. It wasn't an option to keep it going. I'm going to do my part to carry the water, though. I'll have to keep the rivalry going myself over the next couple of years. But I think it's sad to see it go away. But, you know, there's going to be a lot of things that we love about college sports, I think, that are going to be going away over the next few years. And we've all just got to understand that that's the market. That's the way that it goes. And we're going to have to, you know, like I said, I'm 40. I'm immature in a lot of ways, but you know, I want to throw a temper tantrum and you know, about the rivalry going away. But I mean, it's going away. We got to deal with it, and you know, hopefully it'll come back and it'll be good. But you know, I don't know. I think it's sad. It was probably the most enjoyable part about football at BYU, just playing that rivalry game every year. But
people didn't understand how passionate it was. People maybe from other parts of the country, other around the world, that it was so unique, and that it wasn't just football and it wasn't just two nearby universities, but it was religion, it was culture, it was there's so many connections, people who went to high school together, people who worked together. I mean, that was like a 365-day-a-year thing. And it, unlike any other rivalry anywhere else in the country, just because of all of the religious and cultural implications of it. So it really was a fantastic rivalry. I hate to see it go away. But Derek, thank you very much for being here on the Jocularity Show. You can follow him on Twitter at Derek Stevenson. That's DerikStevenson. You won't regret it. He's one of the best follows out there. Great insights, great back and forth with Utah fans. Derek, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely, guys. Thank you.
And now, switching gears and joining us on the phone is anchorwoman for ABC4 Utah, Kim Fisher. Kim, thanks for joining us here on the Jocularity Show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, guys.
So we understand that you are from Texas. Is this true? Can you confirm or deny this rumor that you're a Texas gal out here in Utah?
I can confirm that, y'all.
What part of Texas are you from, Kim?
I grew up around the Houston area in a little area called Sugarland. Ever heard of it?
Yeah, there's a famous country band called Sugarland, right?
There is. The two are not related, though, if you can believe that. So, yeah, I grew up out in Sugarland and then went to school up at North Texas, which is in Denton, just north of Dallas, and then kind of started bouncing around once I graduated with all the TV careers, Abilene, Amarillo, San Antonio, Dallas, and then Utah.
Wow. Well, so yeah. What sports teams did you follow growing up? Were you a Houston fan or a Dallas fan? Or?
Yeah, growing up as a kid, I was an Oilers fan, I was a Rockets fan, and I was an Astros fan. As a matter of fact, we had season tickets to the Stros, but there's only so much of an Astros fan you can be until you want to commit suicide. And so when I moved to Dallas, I became a Texans fan. And then at that point when I moved there, it was still in the 90s. So I'm showing my age. But anyway, the Mavericks were still just a small little team. No one went to their games. And then the following year, they were bought by Mark Cuban, and you saw the team really start to morph and change. And so that was the time when I became a real big Mavs fan, is when you could go to Reunion Arena and there were like 50 people in the stands and you just cheered your heart out for this team that you knew was going to grow into something big. So big Mavs fan, and I'm not going to lie, I could not get on board with the Cowboys. I can't do it.
Good
They're
for you.
They're a bunch of whiners. I can't. And so the past couple of years, I've really been trying to get on board with the Texans and watching them, and I think they're going to be a great team in the future. They just need some growing time.
I'm still trying to picture a young Kim Fisher in the Astrodome back in the rainbow uniform days watching
yep.
guys like J.R. Richard and Nolan Ryan. What are your
yep.
favorite memories of the Astros?
Oh, you know what? Back when I was there, it was still Bagwell and Craig Bigelow or...
Craig Biggio, yeah.
Biggio, that was it. So that was the team that was playing when I was there. But I was an avid softball player. Like, I did the traveling leagues where you played every month of the year. So we would get tickets for the entire team, and all the girls would go up and cheer and watch the Stros.
Wow, I didn't know you were a softball player in the past. Well, now you are out here in Utah. You anchor the news along with Don Hudson at 5, 6, and 10 every weeknight on ABC4. You can catch her on the live stream at goodforutah.com. How long have you been out here in Utah, and how do you like it?
You know, I moved out here back in December of 2011. And so I moved in, and it wasn't a very harsh winter. I'm like, oh, I can handle this. And then the following winter, we got hit pretty hard with some storms. And I'm like, okay, so this is what real snow is like. But, you know, aside from getting used to the snow and learning how to play in it, which is something I've been doing the past couple of years, I've really, really enjoyed being here. There's just so much to do. You can't really get bored.
That's true. Nice people, great scenery, great outdoor
yeah.
activities. I enjoy it here a lot. I've been here for, 9 years now.
Yeah.
Kim, I want to ask you about an event that you've got coming up. You are going to be the MC for Dancing for Hope. That's going to be Saturday, May 31st at Juan Diego High School. That's going to benefit Hope Kids. Tell me a little bit about this evening and this organization.
Oh, man. You know what? This is one of the first organizations I got involved with when I first moved here, just a few months into being here. And I fell in love with what this organization does for kids. So Hope Kids, what it basically is, it's an organization that works with children who have either terminal illnesses or who have disabilities that leave them in the hospital more times than not. And so what Hope Kids does is we throw 15 to 20 fun little events a month that we give to these families for free. They can come out and get out of their hospital rooms and go do something fun, whether it's going to Antelope Island or going and watching a play. It gets them out of that medical muckety-muck that they have to deal with every day and gets them doing things together as a family. And it's just a nice little break for them. So we do those events 15 to 20 times a month. And so this event, Dancing for Hope, is one of our biggest fundraisers of the year so that we can pay for those events for those families and we can keep giving it to them for free. And so what this is it's kind of like a local Dancing with the Stars. So we have 6 celebrity couples, and including, let's see, we've got Nadia Crow here at ABC4 Utah. She's our 4 o'clock anchor. We have Andrew Wittenberg, the morning anchor from KSL. We have Irama Lopez. She is a model and the former Miss Utah International. We have Gretchen Jensen, who is also a former Miss USA and a host of Good Things Utah. Reagan Ledbetter, she's the face of Fresh Market and used to be a GTU host. And then we also have Coach Mack. I'm sure you guys know who that is.
Ron McBride, former University of Utah and Weber State head coach.
You got it. He's dancing. And then we also have Jazz Bear and Jeffrey Denny, who is a Paralympic snowboarder. So we've got a lot of people dancing for this event. We're inviting all of the community to come out, watch them dance. We'll also have some special performances by actual ballroom dancers and hip-hop dancers. And just, you know, famous faces from all over the Utah area will be there just meeting and greeting people. So it's going to be just a day of fun. We'll have a silent auction. We'll have the dance and just let people have fun and watch our celebrities act like complete fools on the dance floor, all for our entertainment.
Kim, how much are tickets and how do people go about obtaining those tickets?
Yes. As a matter of fact, what we want to do tonight for your listeners, we would like to offer a family five-pack for anyone who will go to the Hope Kids Facebook page and like the Hope Kids Facebook page. So tonight, if people go on, it's just facebook.com/HopeKidsUT. If you go on to that, you like the page, we're going to pick one person to get a family five-pack, which is worth $60. Now, if you don't win the family five-pack, the way it works, adults are $25, kids are $7.50, students are $10. And then you can also do a five-pack, which would be two adults and three kids for, I believe that's $60. I should probably know that.
A great
family five-pack for a discounted cost.
A great cause and a small price to pay for such a great event, especially for the opportunity to see Coach Ron McBride dancing up there.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine.
It's going to be a lot of fun. He's got a bunch of cheerleaders that he's dancing with, I'll say that.
Well, Kim, thank you very much for joining us here on the Jocularity Show. You do a fantastic job anchoring the news at 5, 6, and 10 on ABC4. On a personal note, I've worked in a lot of newsrooms with a lot of news anchors, and you are one of the nicest ladies that I have ever had the pleasure to work with. So thank you very much for joining us here, and good luck with the event.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for letting me talk about it.
Time to scratch the surface on the topics that get under your skin. Get ready for Jock Issues.
And leading off our Jock Issues, walk-up music. A staple in baseball for years and years. You know, when a batter is announced and comes up to the plate, they play a little snippet of his favorite music. Well, now they're doing it in the NFL draft, guys. We saw it in the first round, players designating the music they wanted to play as they walked up to the stage to shake hands with Roger Goodell and get their jerseys and hats and pose for their photo ops. And, you know, I guess it was to be expected. It was a lot of, hip-hop music going on. I mean, I like a little bit of everything. I can't say I'm up too much on these songs. For instance, Jadeveon Clowney, the number one pick in the 2014 NFL draft, walked up to a song called The Man by Allo Black. I guess he's the man.
Right over my head.
A song called Happy by Pharrell Williams. That was a very popular one. Several players chose that as their walk-up music. Number three overall pick, Blake Bortles, the quarterback from Central Florida, when he was picked by the Jags, walked up to Blow Up by J. Cole. And several songs listed here. And they're all, you know, I think the one different song was Titans offensive lineman Taylor Lewin from Michigan chose a Kings of Leon song. So that was really the only rock influence. Other than that, it was a lot of Drake. And Young Jeezy.
Was Johnny Manziel's, was his Money, Money, Money? was that his walk-up song? He did the little money hand signal as he walked out on stage. I figured he'd have that as his song as well.
Wait, Manziel? I've never heard of the guy. Are you talking about Johnny Football?
Johnny Football,
I thought Football was his last name.
Excuse me, Johnny Football.
Oh, yeah, that guy. No, he walked up to a song called Draft Day by Drake.
Did Drake actually come out and perform live?
Well, actually, Manziel or Football partied with Drake after the draft. Even though Johnny had to wait till the 22nd pick to be selected by the Cleveland Browns, he went out and celebrated, and Drake was right there by his side. Of course, it seems like Drake is at every sporting event these days. Wasn't he also at the NCAA Finals sporting a Kentucky jersey?
Yes, he was.
So in the spirit of Seinfeld, do you like the Drake? Or do you hate the Drake?
I hate the Drake.
I can't stand the Drake.
I can't. I literally cannot stand the Drake. I don't like him.
So that brings up the question, what would your walk-up music be? If you had 10 seconds in the spotlight with a national TV audience and a packed house at Radio City Music Hall, what song would you like played? And I had to think about this for a while. I had about 10 tracks come to mind, and it was really tough to decide. Alan, what about you?
There's a little band from New York called The Bouncing Souls. They have a song called Mantham. It's I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. It's a pop punk song. I love it, man. My favorite.
Let's hear a little bit of Mantham right now.
I
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that being Alan's walk-up music.
That fits Alan really well.
That's it.
David, how about you?
I would do More Than a Feeling by Boston.
Ooh.
More Than a Feeling. A little classic rock.
Absolutely. I love Boston.
I like it.
Why is that one?
Well, More Than a Feeling, I can jam out to that in my car and my truck. No matter what I'm driving, I can jam out to that one. It was pretty much our anthem. My friend and I, we went to San Diego on a road trip before I got married, and that song came on, and we nearly drove off the road partying while we were driving to that song. And I just love it. I've got a lot of connections to it, a lot of memories with that song, and I just love it. And I love Boston. I listen to them almost every day.
I'm having fun picturing you jamming out in your car.
Oh, it's fun. It is fun.
Can you imagine pulling up at a red light and you look over to your right or your left and you see Dave rocking out to some
Boston? I was
going to
ask, like, when someone pulls up next to you, do you turn it down and just like look straight ahead?
It depends on the song. If there's Taylor Swift on, I'll turn it down.
Well, we all know what it sounds like, but just for Dave's benefit, let's hear a little bit of More Than a Feeling. Oh, yeah, I see my Marianne walking away.
Don't be making fun.
I'm not making fun. That was a tribute. Are you kidding me? That's an homage. I'm all about the classic rock. Well, mine, I got to go with this track with the one caveat. It's a fantastic song. It's a great band. It's one of my favorite albums, but it has been ruined by some of those MTV Jackass guys who used it as their theme song. I think it was a show called Wild and Out or something like that. But this is a song by Turbo Negro called The Age of Pamperius. And you can see that just screams Rick Aaron. That is a badass track that lets you know when I'm walking up to the stage, I mean business. Wow. Right?
Absolutely. Every time I hear that now,
I know
Rick Aaron is just going to come right into my head.
Yep.
Exactly. Fantastic album called Apocalypse Dudes. Check out some Turbo Negro from Norway, of all places. Fantastic band. Anyway, you know I'm all about the music. I'm all about rocking out, right?
You do.
Oh, yeah,
you do
definitely. Music.
And I'm all about sports. And I guess the Venn diagram where my two passions of music and sports kind of overlap, well, there isn't a whole lot of overlap there, but there have been a few instances. It got me thinking with a story this week about when music impacts sports and vice versa. And I'll tell you why I've been thinking about this. The Washington Wizards announced this week that Lady Gaga's concert at the MCI Center in D.C. is going to be moved from May 15th up to May 12th because it conflicts with a possible Game 6 in the Wizards-Pacers playoff series.
Oh.
So that tells you a couple of things. It tells you the NBA takes precedent over Lady Gaga and her legion of fans.
Legion of
Well, I think so. I think a lot of people are really upset. Can you imagine if you bought your tickets to this thing like 8 months ago and made your travel plans? I'm sure people are coming from around the country, around the world, and now they've got to move flights and hotels and everything to be there on the 12th, or they might just miss it. Who knows? They might have to work or something, and they'll miss Lady Gaga. But it also tells me that the Washington Wizards executives,
right,
when they gave this date away at their arena,
right,
had no idea that they would be going this far in the playoffs.
Not expecting
exactly.
to play.
They didn't know.
No, I seriously, can you imagine that conversation? It probably took place like last, you know, August or September. Hey guys, we need the arena for a concert on May 15th. Is that going to be okay? Yeah, sure. Yeah.
No problem. You got it's wide open.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, our last regular season game is April the 12th, yeah. So hey, we're
about,
good.
What about playoffs?
What
are those?
So, NBA 1, Lady Gaga 0. Another thing that happened recently, and I saw this on the internet, and it was so sad that it was funny. This is a band called Great White. Come on, kind of a blues rock, hair metal band from the 80s. I used to listen to them. I still do. Well, they've apparently split up. Now there's a Great White and there's a Jack Russell's Great White. Not a Jack Russell Terrier, but Jack Russell, the singer, has his own version. We've seen this happen with a lot of bands. But Jack Russell's Great White was booked to play following an arena football game by the Trenton Freedom. This was last month in Trenton, New Jersey. The Freedom taking on the Columbus Lions on 80s night at the arena with Jack Russell's Great White performing afterwards. There's only one problem. Nobody stuck around to see the band. Well, it was a minor league arena football game, so there weren't that many people to begin with. Probably about 800 in the stands.
Oh, like, did they not know about the concert, though?
Well, it must not have been very well publicized, or it was publicized, and people voted with their feet because everybody left. And by the time they set up the amps and the monitors and Great White came out and played, there were an estimated 40 people in an 8,500-seat arena.
Kidding me.
And this has unfortunately made it onto the internet, and you can see and hear it here. Not a bad performance. They sound pretty good. They're giving it their honest effort, despite there only being 40 people there. But if you look at the video online, the sad thing is, looks like about 20 of the 40 people are the janitorial staff cleaning up the arena.
They're sweeping brooms behind them.
You can see Jack Russell and his band playing on the arena floor, and literally guys are walking past them collecting the garbage can liners out of the trash cans. Sadly, this is not the most disastrous gig Great White has ever played. Of course, back in 2003, they were playing when a nightclub fire in Rhode Island killed 100 people and injured 203. That was back in February of 2003 at a club called The Station. So, I don't know, Great White, not so great anymore. Kind of a downer note. But there is this rock and roll arena football connection for some reason. And you talk about sports music connections. Of course, John Bon Jovi owned the Philadelphia Soul of the Arena Football League. And now there's a team called the LA Kiss. Have you seen this nonsense?
I have. The LA Kiss, they have the best looking field in the Arena Football League and the best looking uniforms and helmet in the Arena Football League as well.
Yeah, this is a brainchild of Gene Simmons, who apparently is determined to slap the KISS logo on every single product and service offered for sale in the United States.
Well, you've heard of the KISS coffin, right? The KISS coffin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a real thing.
Yeah, it is.
It's got a KISS logo, right? Like airbrushed on the coffin?
Yeah, it's a KISS coffin.
That's the KISS coffin. It's available for only $10,000. The offer expires when you do.
Thank you, Gene Simmons, for that. He's quite the businessman. Well, I started thinking about other sports and music connections, and I couldn't help but think about the 1985 Chicago Bears.
The Super Bowl Shuffle.
Yes. Of course.
Yes.
They are the only U.S. professional sports team to ever make the Billboard singles charts. They reached number 41 on the Billboard Hot 100 with the Super Bowl Shuffle. It was an idea. A guy in Chicago wrote the song. Somehow he got it to Willie Gault. Willie recruited other Bears, notably Jim McMahon and Richard Dent. And people went crazy for this.
They still do. I love that. I love watching that on YouTube. I wasn't even 2 years old Yeah, when this came out, and I still watch it on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah, they had a big anniversary recently. Actually, this is what surprised me. The song, the Super Bowl Shuffle by the Shufflin' Crew, was nominated for a Grammy.
Oh, you're kidding me. It's so bad.
Oh, my Lord, I didn't know that.
It's so bad.
It was up in the Best Rhythm and Blues Performance by a Duo or Group category. It eventually lost to the song Kiss by Prince. Or these guys would have been Grammy winners.
Wow.
In addition to Super Bowl winners. There have been a number of imitators since. A lot of teams have put out songs nowhere near the success of the Super Bowl Shuffle. The 1984 San Francisco 49ers put out a record called We Are the 49ers. And later in the 80s, the 49ers put out another one called the 49ers Rap. Several other teams tried this. Nobody has ever replicated the success of the Super Bowl Shuffle and the funky QB known as McMahon. You look back now and it looks so goofy and hokey, and it was
awkward, wasn't it?
No,
I think it's awkward,
but yeah. No, people thought it was cool. I mean, it was like, hey, these are football players and they're up there rapping. This is awesome.
It just shows you how bad the 80s was. So
hey,
bad.
That's my decade.
It's mine too. I'm just oh man,
another NFL musical moment that we all remember. January 27th, 1991, Whitney Houston performing the Star Spangled Banner before the Super Bowl. And that one actually made it onto the Billboard charts, made it up to number 20. They released that as a single. Of course, we were just a few days into the Persian Gulf War. There was a big patriotic spirit. She stepped up and knocked it out of the park. Probably the most memorable national anthem before any sporting event. And I didn't realize this. 10 years later, after 9/11, 2001, her version was re-released, and it made it all the way to number one.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the national anthem and all the singers that do a great job with it, and then you bring in actors that try to do it, like Roseanne Barr, and you listen to that, and then you listen to Whitney Houston. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, she really did a great job with it, the late, great Whitney Houston. And then maybe my favorite memory of music and sports happened when I was just a kid. It was July 12th, 1979. You guys ever heard of this? Disco Demolition Night.
Ooh,
I have heard of it, and I read a little bit on it too. Absolutely.
This was it was either the greatest or the worst promotion in the history of professional sports. Just a quick rundown of what happened. The Chicago White Sox, owned by Bill Veeck, he was always looking for a promotion, trying to get people in the gates and in the seats. They had a doubleheader against the Detroit Tigers, and a Chicago DJ decided to have Demolition Derby Night, Disco Demolition Night is what it was. What basically everybody who brought a disco record would get into the game for 98 cents, and then between the games, they were going to blow up the records out in the outfield.
Right.
But the problem was, this got more popular than anybody imagined, and they had an estimated 70,000 people in Comiskey Park that night. More than they could actually hold. They were turning people away, and people were getting ladders and climbing up the walls to get in. And, of course, a crowd that size and that unruly, and they were, you know, as drunk and high and whatever else as they were. Well, it turned into a fiasco. They blew up the albums, and then people started pouring out onto the field and basically starting a riot. They set the field on fire. They wouldn't leave, and they were just out there partying, doing who knows what. Here's what announcer Jimmy Pearsall had to say about it.
You people see what's going on here at Comiskey Park. One of the saddest sights I've ever seen in a ballpark in my life. This garbage of demolishing a record has turned into a fiasco.
A fiasco indeed. The umpires determined that the field was unplayable. Once cops were able to sweep everybody off of the field, there were 39 arrests for disorderly conduct.
I mean, look at Google image the images of this field. There's no way you could play a game on that.
Well, there were holes dug in the outfield. Parts of the field were burned. And it turned into basically a gigantic rock concert / riot / Woodstock hippie party.
What year was this?
This was 1979, and this was kind of the height of the disco era with, you know, Donna Summer and the Bee Gees and stuff. And this was the big backlash.
These people really hated disco.
Well, they blew up the records in the outfield, and that's when it all, like Kirk was saying, that's when it all, just everything blew up then with the record.
ESPN did a fantastic documentary on this whole thing. You can find it on YouTube, but you have to see it just to see this crazy scene and these baseball players standing around wondering, what the heck is going on? Who are these people, and get them off the field so we can play ball? Wow. Disco Demolition Night. Go take a look. Another jock issue on the docket. Tommy Lasorda, speaking of baseball, longtime Dodgers manager, still active in the Dodgers organization. I guess he was getting some kind of honorary degree in Florida recently, and he was interviewed by the ABC affiliate in Florida, and they asked him what they thought about V. Stiviano, the mistress of Donald Sterling, who secretly recorded the discussion and I guess is going to be responsible for taking down Sterling's ownership of the L.A. Clippers.
Oh, yeah.
And she's a piece of work herself. I don't know if you guys saw the interview that she did with Barbara Walters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, you know, she's, you know, a taco short of a combination plate herself, not to be ethnic or anything.
I like that one. I can steal that one.
But you know, Barbara said, you know, what was your role for Donald Sterling? And she said this.
Can you tell me what your relationship with Donald Sterling is?
I'm his confidant, his best friend, his silly rabbit.
His what?
His silly rabbit.
His silly rabbit?
Yes.
Is that what he calls you?
No. That's I call myself that.
I say, okay.
Silly rabbit? Tricks are for kids. What is going on with her? And she's walking around in that visor and everything? Well, anyway, Lasorda was asked what he thought about V. Stiviano. And he says, talking about Sterling now, I've been a friend of that guy's for 30 years. It doesn't surprise me that he said those things. That doesn't surprise me. And he shouldn't have said it. And he just hurt himself by talking too much and doing things that he shouldn't be doing. As for his thoughts on Stiviano?
And I tell you, I don't wish that girl any bad luck, but I hope she gets hit with a car.
Wow.
I hope she gets hit by a car.
Tommy. Easy holy, now.
Holy Toledo.
Now, is Tommy going to face some kind of a backlash or sanctions from Major League Baseball for wishing some kind of death or dismemberment?
Now, if a car does hit her, which we hope it doesn't, we're all going to come back to the Tommy Lasorda put a hit out on her. Holy cow.
I hope that she's a Dodger if a car comes after her, is able to jump out of the way. So, Tommy, easy there, big guy. That's the last thing you need at this point.
Time to hear what you're saying in 140 characters or less. A little bird tells us these are the tweets of the week.
And for our tweets of the week, we go back to the National Football League, where for some reason this week, Commissioner Roger Goodell thought it would be a good idea to have a Q&A session on Twitter. Now, I get the feeling that Mr. Goodell has never really been on Twitter. Doesn't really understand the concept.
No, not at all.
Of Twitter. I think he just kind of said, "Oh, you know what might be a good idea? Let's engage in a little lively social media with some of the football enthusiasts." And I'm sure some assistant said, "Well, Mr. Goodell, you know, maybe not a good idea." Oh, pish posh, poppycock!
Poppycock!
Silence you! I wish to be hip and young like the fan base and engage with some of our enthusiasts out there, some of the fans of our organizations. Well, as you can imagine, they put out this hashtag, Ask the Commish, or Ask Kamish. And of course, it was a disaster.
Right from the beginning.
Oh,
right from the beginning.
How could they expect it to be anything but?
Well, exactly.
Exactly.
This is what tells me he had no concept of, right, the wild, wild west. Because you put out anything, the most innocuous statement, you say good morning on Twitter, and there's going to be 100 people coming back with screw you. And
it's raining. It's not a good morning. How can you get a good morning out of this?
And it gets worse from there. Now, there are some nice people on Twitter. I'm sitting here with two of them in the room right now, but there are a lot of angry, unhappy, miserable trolls out there too. So this is what happened when they put out the Ask Kamish soliciting questions for Roger Goodell to answer. Ace Boogie, right off the bat, tweets, "Why are you the devil? Why do you suck at your job? Why did they hire you?" Okay. we're off and running with this.
Well, the first one was uncalled for. Why are you the devil? The second one I can understand. And the third one actually has a little bit of legs. Right. That's a legitimate question.
Right, it is.
And Goodell did not respond to that one, as you can imagine. And then it continued from there. At Canned Lobster on Twitter said, "I've got a question. Is there anyone anywhere more out of touch and incompetent than you?" Again, he didn't respond to that one either.
Oh, my goodness.
Where is this lively back and forth that he was looking for? Amanda at PGH Steelers Girl on Twitter says, "Do you feel guilty of profiting off of breast cancer or nah?" Well, you know, they have Breast Cancer Month, and they sell all the pink jerseys and pink towels and pink socks and cleats and stuff like that. I don't know if the league profits off of it.
I don't know if the league profits that. I would hope not.
I think it's weird. I'm all for supporting breast cancer and breast cancer research. But I think maybe if you do it for like one week or one set of games or something, but the entire month, which is basically one quarter of the season, to have these guys running around in these pink uniforms, it looks strange. It's bizarre.
It almost defeats the purpose.
It's almost overkill, right?
Right, because it's supposed to be something fresh, and you see the pink jerseys, and you're like, oh, what's going on? And you find out it's about breast cancer. But when you see it every week, it's like you get used to it. It's not the same. It doesn't have the same impact.
At SteveUDS on Twitter responded to the hashtag AskKamish with, "If you were stranded on a deserted island with only one book to keep you company, wouldn't that be better for everyone?" Ouch! At Lucavino on Twitter said, "What's in your head? You know, since there's no brain. I mean, is it empty or is it filled with, say, human excrement?" Oh my God.
This was the commissioner actually at a computer watching these come in, or were they being fed to him? There had to be a filter in between and the commissioner.
I'm sure.
I bet a team of interns was filtering these out, and
as there's laughing in the other room, what are they laughing about?
I'm sure 20 minutes in, Goodell said, "Have any questions come in there, kids?" Not yet, commish. Hang on. Saeed Jones at The Ferocity on Twitter says, "Have the anonymous industry good old boys decided the NFL can handle out gay players yet? Asking for a friend." Okay, we've got the Michael Sam from Missouri coming into the league as an openly gay player. Jack Kogod at Unsilent on Twitter says, "What did you know and when did you know it? Hashtag Benghazi."
Getting
a little political there.
Clever.
And it continues. At Anthony Sanford says, "Can you donate me that $9.5 billion you make? Since you're nonprofit, I'll take your profit." The NFL, believe it or not, is actually a nonprofit organization. They were established that way years and years ago.
Where does all the money go?
It goes into the human fund.
money for people.
Billionaires who own the league and own the teams. Michael Curry on Twitter said, "Who's more immoral, an employer that covers up his workers getting brain trauma or an employer tolerating abusers but not gays?" Ooh.
Well, A little harsh, but there's some legitimate question in there.
Well, the brain trauma is legit, and I guess a little allusion there to Richie Incognito or other people who've committed domestic violence outside of the game. Pitcher Brandon McCarthy of the Arizona Diamondbacks. This guy is a great follow on Twitter, at BMcCarthy32. He always comes up with clever things. He tweets, "Is it true that all Super Bowl stadia now have a master light switch covered in tape saying, 'Roger, do not touch,' and a winky face?" Since we had a lights out situation in the Super Bowl. Drew McGarry on Twitter says, "One of your owners probably committed wide-scale fraud. Can we ignore that and talk about Jadeveon Clowney's motor instead?" He was referring to Jimmy Haslam, the owner, allegedly has committed fraud.
Right.
So a couple of people made reference to that. Bilal Ukda at Our Blick on Twitter says, "What's worse, Jimmy Haslam committing fraud or someone dunking over a goalpost?"
Apparently a goalpost dunk
well,
is.
Well, that's been it, outlawed.
Right,
I mean,
exactly. You can't do that.
Haslam's fraud maybe continues, or his alleged fraud, but dunking over a goalpost, no more. Drew McGarry also tweeted, "Would you rather fight 100 horse-sized ducks or help an owner extort $300 million from a municipal treasury?" Kind of a hypothetical question there. David Roth tweeted at Commissioner Goodell, "Any plans to get fans more access to the owners? Maybe a Jimmy Haslam curated TED Talk style series on innovation and ethics."
Nice.
Oh, wow.
See, the commissioner just getting hammered on Twitter.
Did he answer any of these?
No, these he didn't answer. He answered questions like, "I'd like to be an NFL owner one day. What? What should I study?" And he responded one word: leadership. Okay, thank you for that.
Wow.
Thanks, Roger.
In depth.
Roger that.
Roger, Roger.
At RunCMCC says, "I have a small business with about 300 employees. Any advice on busting their union?" Because the NFL Players Association, right. not too effective. At Dagatron said on Twitter, "Who you got in 2016? Rand Paul or Rand Paul?" Another political tweet there. At Will McAvoy, ACN, says, "The NBA is kicking out an owner for being racist. You continue to allow a team to operate with an ethnic slur as a nickname. Why?"
That's actually a good question.
That is a good question. And he didn't answer it?
Washington Redskins. No, that one was not addressed. But
That would have been a good one. It would have been a great opportunity for some good PR.
Yeah.
I mean,
it would have been fun to see that asked at a press conference,
sure,
where he couldn't dodge it,
right,
as easily as on Twitter. At Mitch DMS tweeted, "Two questions. Number one, ever had insensitive, potentially career-ending remarks secretly recorded? And number two, if no, would you please?" Yeah, just giving it to the commissioner.
Man, Roger Goodell is more hated than David Stern ever was, it seems like.
But you know what? Anybody could go on Twitter and say, "Hey, ask me questions." And, you know, it could be Mother Teresa. And 99 of the first 100 would be
true.
Like, you know, why are you such a stupid, you know what? Right. At Jose on Twitter says, "How much wood could a woodchuck chuck if it wasn't suffering brain trauma from 12 years as an NFL offensive lineman?"
How much wood could a chuck if it is suffering? Would be another follow-up question.
Inquiring minds want to know. At Sports Pickle tweeted, "What level of football did you play that makes you think it's possible to avoid head-to-head contact at high speeds?"
Another good question.
That's a legitimate question,
right?
It
is.
Yeah, they're trying to, you know, every year they seem to come up with the different things that are outlawed. And, I mean, it's large men who run very fast running into each other at high speeds. You're never going to legislate the danger out of the game. At Jesus Nice said simply, "Why do you hate fun?" Hashtag ask commish. At Jerry Thornton 1 says, "Rank your bad ideas 1 through 5. 18-game season, more London games, team in London, expanded playoffs, or Thursday night football?
Not all bad ideas.
Thursday night. I kind of like Thursday night as a college football only night, but I've gotten used to the idea of having an NFL game there too. So really, you only have to suffer through Tuesday and Wednesday.
Right.
Because between Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday football, Monday night football, Tuesday and Wednesday until they start throwing those MAC games.
Yeah, MACtion. You get some MACtion on ESPN on Wednesday nights. MACtion. The MAC.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, I like it.
That's what it's called.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
That's okay.
That's not David Wilbur term. That's actual
all right,
universe
I didn't know that.
Terminology.
Sometimes you actually get some Conference USA-tion as well. At Ethan Booker on Twitter, continued the onslaught on Commissioner Goodell. He says, who's your favorite rapist, murderer, or ticking time bomb that you currently employ?
Oh, my goodness. Holy Toledo.
And finally, at Jerry Verha says, can I be commish for a day? And Goodell responded to this one, quote, from seeing some of these Ask Commish tweets, you sure you want to?
<That's> well, at least he had some fun with it.
Right.
So, he took a beating in the Twitter sphere. And I imagine this will be the last question and answer session on Twitter that you see a major sports commissioner or major sports figure get involved in, because I think by now everybody has kind of learned.
Yeah, not to do it. I think Adam Silver, I think would be good.
You see the ovation he got in Oklahoma City?
Absolutely. I think people actually like him. They liked him before David Stern. Now they like him now. I think that you'd get some of these jackassy responses, but you'd get some actual good responses. Yep. And I think Silver would respond to both questions.
Yeah.
Well, David and Alan, as you know, this is the Jocularity Show, so we're not interested in the legitimate questions. The jackassery responses is all we care about here. And that's going to do it for this edition of the Jocularity Show. I would like to thank our guests, Derek Stevenson and Kim Fisher, for joining us this evening. Alongside Alan Martindale and David Wilbur, I'm Rick Aaron, and we will see you later.
For show information, go to our website, jocularityshow.com. You can email us at jocularityshow@tornbysports.com and follow us on Twitter @jocularityshow.